This morning I'll read from Dean Hill. Special 715, Mr. Page.
I have with me this morning Mr. Guinness on my right, Mr. Barton on my left, and Mr. Espy. Mr. Hanson will join us at 11 o'clock, and if he's required, Mr. Ryder might join us after that. Mr. Ryder, as you might recall, is the geotechnical expert who provided the report. We're not anticipating arising from the officer's report that there's any particular issue arising about geotechnical matters that might be of concern today, but if you would be assisted by having him here and hearing from him, then that can be arranged.
We'll discuss that at the morning agenda.
Okay. Well then, shall we start? So I filed yesterday afternoon some open legal submissions. I am in somewhat in your hands is the most effective way to play today. We have ample time, and in the ordinary course of events, I will begin by presenting submissions and then all witnesses in a sequence with the planner going last to evaluate what's been heard. Bearing in mind that you've had my open submissions, I wonder whether it might be more useful to move to the evidence and then deal with any legal issues that arise from that evidence afterwards, or I'm happy simply to commence in the usual way and speak to what I have filed. As you will have observed, there isn't, in fact, a great deal of law that arises from my legal submissions in any case. I don't think that this is the kind of submission that will turn necessarily on legal principles.
I just explained that if you take the door off and if the tape breaks, it automatically locks. You can get out, but the public can't get out.
Right. I'm not sure whether that's a cunning plan or not. I don't know.
I'm not sure either. Yes, I understand that the law, as you set out, is pretty straightforward in this particular case.
Yes.
Perhaps it might be useful if we were to just, if there are any questions on the submissions, we just ask you about those first, and then you could then come back.
Yes.
Later.
I think so. Because by the time we've got to the supplementary evidence that Mr. Geddes is going to produce, there is a fair amount of detail to work our way through, and that's likely to result in a discussion which it might be best served at the end of the case rather than dealing with that initiated right at the outset. Because really the big ticket issues for this submissions are the residential state highway areas A, B and C that Ms. Jones and Dr. Reed don't support. And so it's likely that the main issues of significance are going to be the principles about how we resolve the differences of opinion in relation to those particular areas. There are some other things relating to the road that Mr. Barker will talk about, and issues have been raised around the airstrip noise issues that Mr. Geddes and I can both address for you at the appropriate time.
Questions? Yes, yes. Wastewater is something that needs to be dealt with.
Yes, and that's why Mr. Hanson is coming along, and he will be here at 11, and so he will be able to discuss with you whether there is any material risk that on-site disposal of treated wastewater presents any risk to the water supply boards.
I think it's a little bit wider than that, Mr. Page. We have to make recommendations consistent with the regional water plan. And we also have to give effect to the national policy statement on fresh water management. and not being consistent with the water conservation order on the lake.
Yes.
So it's rather more than a public health issue that needs to be addressed in that respect.
All right, well, thank you for that indication. That's not something that had immediately arisen from the reporting, but we will certainly bear that in mind before Mr. Hanson arrives.
Other than that, did you have a question you want to raise now?
No, I'm
kidding.
That's normal, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll go into the evidence.
I'm just
going to
have a
quick question.
Some of it, you may refer to the evidence, but if you have raised them. Paragraph 25, you say the driving is out, and you may remind on that point for active facilities.
Yes.
I'm just a little confused about how we get right and what the nature of the arrangement is. There is some sort of agreement already.
Yes, there is. There is a document which was executed by the founding parties called the Tripartite Agreement. And that makes provision for access to shared services, and in particular makes provision for cost sharing in relation to establishment and maintenance. So Marajat Road was established as a substitution for Woolshed Road, which once extended all the way to the Lake Shore, which was a public road. But that road was stopped and replaced with Narragat Road, which is not a public road. So there is an access, there is an enablement for Homestead Bay to use Narragat Road to a point. And the point is in relation to the contributions, the financial contributions that need to be made to the owner of that road for its maintenance and upkeep. Now, there is no current entitlement to use that road for the extended zone, as is now sought. Now, the solution to that is the new connection to the state highway that Mr. Bartlett has assessed and discussed. Now, I'm not saying to you that the Jardines couldn't use Marajat Road, only that it will require the agreement of the owner of the road to do so, or for it to vest in the council. I'm not aware of any moves afoot to do the latter.
So, you have alternatives.
Yes.
You could end up with a new access to Marajat Road as well as a new access road, or you could just end up with a new access road alone.
Correct.
And either would serve.
Correct.
I thought that was what I wanted to clarify that. Now, Woolshed Road.
Yes.
That was stopped, well, at the point where the gate now is?
I'm just trying to remember.
Do you remember where the legal road along the Woolshed Road stopped? I think it is at the boundary of Homestead Bay.
Yeah. From the gate, it extends further down towards the lake. Mm-hmm. We run along the fence line, if you remember correctly. There's a, there were some pine trees on there, but from the gate, I think you can get a 200 metres in a straight line from the gate.
What I will do, without wishing to burden you with more paper, is give you a hard copy of my own submissions, because attached to it is a plan that I was simply going to do a little bit of orientation boots of cardboard box. So, we can begin the explanation again by reference to plans on the back of my submission.
So we brought your vote on this.
Might have had a hold up in identifying. It'd be easier if you did that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you can all see in one go as it's walking around.
Yeah. Now it's my understanding that the legal road is intended to get to the village area, which brings you from the gate, which I have up here at the end of the row of pines.
The northwestern point of that plantation, is that the end of
the gate?
That's the very point. Short film? Yeah.
Yep. And in a straight line that would get you down to approximately where the lot 7, ZB 504891 references.
Mm. Right, so if it's in a straight line, why have we got curly lock boundaries?
Why?
Yeah.
That's not a good
on this?
Yes.
That's a good question. Well, yeah. What are we looking at on this? Is this a...
Is the answer that the...
Well,
the gap between lot 5 and lot 7 is actually a legal road.
Yeah,
sorry sir, but it was my understanding it was in a straight line.
when you drive on it,
yeah.
Yes.
Then you've got me talking about that. Simply if Mr. Hanson's coming in at 11 o'clock, if I would tell him to bring down our tea plant.
That might help, because the other question
that,
of course
is... attributes to that.
Well, and we've also got a gap that appears to be a road or something between lot 2 and lot 5. The status of that would be useful to understand as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that isn't a legal road. I know that's a good service. I believe that's a parcel, that's a strip owned by Coneman Water Supply.
Right.
Yeah.
So does Woolshed Road have any part to play in this development?
Woolshed Road doesn't have a part to play in the development now. It certainly did at the earliest days of the outset of the Jack's Point Resort Zone, but the simple proposition for you in this hearing is that access to the Homestead Bay structure plan is obtained either through Maori Jack Road or the new alignment, or the new access to the State Highway through Lot 8 that Mr. Bartlett said was what it was.
Would there be any access through the new access to the State Highway being built as part of the Henry Downs extension?
I don't know the answer to that.
Mm. Well, lots of roads are instantly, aren't they?
Yes, because you can get from Maori Jack Road through to Henry Downs as opposed to going up the State Highway by Maori Jack Road.
Mm.
Now, Mr. Barton's a resident of Jack's Point. He knows the road network better than I do, so perhaps that's a question that you might be able to
do. Well, he probably knows it better than anyone, which is the most confusing road network. Obviously designed by people who believe in... development theory in the 1960s, if you don't have straight roads.
Yes.
I suppose the quick answer is although there is the legal road corridor for a 40 road, it's not been formed. And therefore, you need specify three things to actually be able to get that full linking. Once all the different developments of Henley Downs, Hanley Farm, Jack's Point, and then potentially down to Homestead Bay are all developed, then there may be some interconnectivity. Until those plans are released, or that sort of thing, I really don't know much more.
So, changing the subject, and if you go to paragraph 29, where we're talking about airstrip launch, or aircraft launch, and your opposition that new residents would come to the situation with their ears open, as it were, and would only have a job to blame. But I'm just wondering where, having been around local government a long time, including management positions, I've not my experience of people behaving that way. They come along and then they're not happy and they want to complain, they do complain. Yes. And so where is it in law that you can apply a proposition like that?
Only insofar as that the existing airport operations are a part of the existing environment. And so they cannot maintain that their environment is being adversely affected because it is their environment. So I'm not suggesting to you that there isn't a capacity to complain. There is always a right to complain. All I'm suggesting to you is that the complaint doesn't have merit. Now, as it happens, that isn't the end of the matter from the Jardine's point of view. Mr. Geddes has devised a proposal for your consideration that he'll present as evidence about the establishment of a 55 dBA LDN contour at time of subdivision, and provision made for insulation for any property that should happen to fall within that 55 dBA LDN contour.
In that case, I'll save the questions I have on that issue, Mr. Geddes.
Yes. Now, the reason why we haven't done it now is you will appreciate that substantial earthworks are part of the proposal which is being advanced, and it is anticipated that the earthworks will have an influence about where that contour might lie, and we can't predict in advance what the influence of that's going to be.
I suppose that's the sort of thing you could always add back for modeling later on and rerun it. Those models are very sensitive to landfall.
Yes. Well, I suppose the practical answer is that we haven't done it.
Right.
Could it be done? Probably it could be. But what we're saying is that so long as there is a robust mechanism that can be introduced, then the recommendations of Dr. Childs can be accommodated.
The elephant in the room, of course, is that we actually have no idea how wide that contour will extend.
No, we don't. That's correct.
Until it's done. It could be done on a provisional basis with and without that done, actually. Of course, they've been done.
Well, let's imagine that it was done. That would give us a 55 dBA LDN contour, and it would still beg the question about what we then do with that.
You'd know the size of the problem.
Not the size of the problem, although would know what was in and what was out there. My submission to you is that the airport noise standard, which makes provision for these 55 and 65 contours, doesn't anticipate that residential activities would be prohibited between 55 and 65, but only that appropriate measures are in place to ensure an internal noise amenity within a residence. And it's reasonably commonplace for provision for acoustic standards to be made in plans within the contours. And so that's the kind of mechanism that we would be suggesting to you.
In my experience, a lot of it in this field, it's pretty unusual to allow for suburban residential development between 55 and 65. You sometimes allow for rural dwellers with little insulation, as you say. That's a common enough approach. Certainly around Christchurch Airport, if the three councils consider.
There's also a decision of the environmental courts in Manukau pointing out that the New Zealand lifestyle involves being outside, and the outside area within the 55 dBA is not a pleasant environment and inconsistent with suburban life. So that supports Commissioner Mountford's suggestion that just insulating the houses may not be an appropriate approach. And if we don't know the extent of the area, then that does create a conundrum for us.
Well, that's not how I read the Skyline decision of the Environment Court dealing with this particular airstrip, that they were that the 55 dBA LDN contour had significance in terms of outside noise amenity. Certainly the court recorded its view that the standard dealt with appropriate internal amenity, because that's what the standard says.
Well, of course, there are differences between this airstrip and Auckland or Christchurch International Airport.
Yes.
And the nature of the development that isn't
frequent
around this
one.
Yes.
From memory, that. That, and I'd need to reread it, but I thought the issue the court was dealing with on the Skyline one was the noise, when it dealt with external noise, was the noise on the golf course.
Yes, it was, and other places as well, but the court did record that the airport noise standard didn't have anything to say about those kinds of amenity values. It was the internal noise environment in a dwelling that the standard was designed to address.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that we ignore the external amenities.
No, it doesn't mean that you should ignore the external amenities. What I'm saying to you, though, is if we're going to use the 55 dBA LDN contour, which is a feature of the airport noise standard, what we use it for is the purpose that the standard has, which is to identify those locations where residential dwellings will require some kind of acoustic performance standard.
I'm not sure that you can rely on that narrow interpretation, because clearly, while the standard deals with that, we have to consider the amenity effects on the properties overall. And a residential property includes more than the dwelling. And we have to consider the amenity effects on that. If the evidence is that the noise environment is 55 dBA or greater, then we would have to consider the amenity effects on the external environment.
Well, I can't say to you that that's irrelevant. All I'm suggesting to you is that if we're going to use the contour, our proposition is that contour is used for the equal standard purpose, which is to identify where acoustic insulation might be required. If you're saying no residential activities, irrespective of buildings, should be permitted within that contour, then that's a different proposition.
I don't think that's what the proposition I put to you. And I think that the interpretation of the standard you're using is actually not quite correct. The standard is designed to work in two ways. And one way is to set a limit on the use of an airport within the 55, to set a 55 dBA contour, and that limits the noise that that airport can generate. When there are certain activities within that area, then they require acoustic insulation, according to the standard.
Yes.
But the creation of the contour itself creates a factual circumstance of a noise environment that has amenity effects that we need to consider. Now, that doesn't mean that we would necessarily say that it's prohibitive to have residential development in the area, but it does affect, we have to take recognition of the amenity effects that were created by that 55 dBA contour and the higher noise limits within it.
Yes. So, does that then boil down to whether it's appropriate for a suitably informed purchaser to make a choice about that for themselves, or whether it is for council to determine whether a person should be entitled to live in that environment?
I think experience may have demonstrated in other places that it's almost impossible for a person to be suitably informed before they've had the experience. They might know in their head that there might be a problem, but until you experience it, you won't really appreciate it.
It becomes a reverse sensibility issue that has to be taken account of. And while there's nothing that says that we cannot recommend zonings which might lead to reverse sensitivity issues, the question becomes whether those reverse sensitivity, how we deal with those reverse sensitivity issues. And I think that's apparent in this instance that there are already reverse sensitivity issues, which is the reason that Skyline's application was declined by the Environment Court.
Yes. Well, so what we've... those with reverse sensitivity issues, which have resulted in the airport operations not able to be extended, those already exist. And so what we're simply saying is that if it was an acceptable decision to allow a residential within 55 dBA LDN contour on the north side of the airstrip, then there's no reason in principle why the same treatment isn't possible on the south side of the airstrip. And so if there are reverse sensitivity issues, then they are already at play, and there's no reason to think that they will be made worse because they already exist.
The other point that I will throw into the mix on this question is chapter 26, which is the noise chapter. And rules, as notified number was 36514, the fixed wing aircraft, and I don't think it's been challenged at all. Sets a limit of 55 dBA at the national boundary of any residential unit, or within any point within a residential site other than the residential units on the same site as the activity. Now, would the development of residential sites in that area create a circumstance where N-zones that now lives would be relying purely on existing use rights for surviving?
No, it's relying on its current resource consent.
But its current resource consent doesn't set noise limits,
does it? No, it doesn't. It sets operational limits.
Mm. So it would still then have to comply with that rule, wouldn't it?
I don't think it's
either going to comply with the rule or rely on existing use rights in respect of that rule.
No, that's not the right approach. The activity that is authorised by the resource consent is authorised on its terms.
Mm-hmm.
The a subsequent rule that becomes has legal effect after the resource consent granted. It doesn't constrain the exercise of that consent. The activity is authorised. There is an overriding Section 16 obligation, certainly.
Mm. So then, that leads us to the question then, if that's the circumstance, should we be creating a situation where the operational activities of that airport is in conflict with the policy direction and rule direction of the district plan?
If my recollection serves, that rule applies only to the Queenstown Wanaka airports.
No, this rule applies to all fixed-wing aircraft in the district. There is a provision in the rural zone that allows X number of flights per week on the basis that that limited number would comply with that rule.
Mm.
And that has separation distances, etc. So the rural zone rule and this rule work in tandem. Instead of policy, that there should be a separation such that residential sites are subject to 55 PPA.
Yes. Well, if it were to be the case that the operation of this airport under its existing consent wouldn't comply with the current rule in the proposed plan, then that would be something that would have to fall to be evaluated through its own consent process.
But aren't we supposed to be recommending a district plan that involves integrated management of natural and physical resources to achieve the purpose of the Act? And wouldn't that be zoning in such a way that we don't create policy conflicts, which is the antithesis of integrated management?
Well, I see the difficulty here as a sequence one, because what the rule, if I understand the Chapter 36 provisions correctly, what it does is control the establishment of new airports in circumstances where that would have adverse effects on residential amenity. Here we've got the reverse position. Here we've got an existing consented airstrip whose effects are known, and we have a proposal to establish to allow residential activities to be established. And so, in my submission, the issue is one more of reverse sensitivity than the effects that the airstrip has. Because people are coming to an existing environment. Now,
the difficulty we have is with the effects. While we know there are effects, we do not know the extent of those effects, and
yes,
that is the point we are grappling with, and
yes,
that is the whole purpose of Commissioner Malcolm's question as to why do we not have the 55 DBA contours,
yes,
at present to assist us in considering this submission.
Well, well, the simple answer is if you don't have them, what we're saying is that we will produce them. It's just a question of whether you need those contours now to inform your decision, or whether you can have sufficient comfort that the production of those contours, once the earthworks has been done, coupled with a mechanism, will enable a sufficient integration of the issues to enable you to make a decision.
So,
yesterday, from the discussion with the council, was referred to the capacity of the land and the issues raised in the evidence of Mr. Osborne about development capacity and how much is needed and where and so on. And so it was a question of considering the intensity of the use that could be permitted. So it's not just, it's a two-fold problem, it's not just, well, it's an amplification of reverse sensitivity if you increase intensity in the vicinity of the airfield compared to perhaps the council scenario A, which would be the evidence of the There's a context to this discussion.
I understand that context. It strikes me, though, that your decision is really a, firstly, one of principle, which is to say, is this an appropriate location for residential activity at all? And if it is, in what circumstances? Because if it's the areas A, B, and C, which are thought to be the most sensitive to aircraft noise coming and going from the airstrip, then if that's an acceptable noise environment for one, two, or three houses, then I do not see in principle why that wouldn't be an acceptable noise environment for the density which has been proposed. Either it's acceptable or it isn't.
Just another question of clarification on your paragraph 32. You state the number of flights is controlled directly through the existing airport system.
Yes.
Do you know what that... Can you elaborate on, or can Mr. Giddes elaborate on what is permitted?
35
flights per day. Is aircraft flight regulated by that resource system?
No, it isn't. However, there's an interesting observation made by the court in the Skydive case. I've got hard copies of the case with me.
I'd like to read it at some point, actually.
What's that?
At some point, I'll have to read that.
Let me hand up copies to add to your paperwork. I'm sure you have electronic versions already, but... Although the court observed that there wasn't an obligation through the resource consent to a not particular aircraft type, it did express an Overton view that the obligations under Section 16 may well require NZone to adopt new technology as it becomes available to diminish the aircraft noise. Because the proposition that NZone had been running in the Skydive case was that its transition from an earlier version of a Cessna aircraft to a later version that used gas turbine engines substantially diminished the noise footprint of the airport. Therefore, a larger number of flights ought to be enabled. And the court said, no, that doesn't follow, because you've got an obligation under Section 16 to take all the steps. Anyway. So then I think probably it makes sense to go to Mr. Espy next.
Part of the original topography, whereas the proposed mounting
will be in a location that's characterised by large open paddocks. Therefore, the proposed treatment will significantly and adversely alter the landscape character of the Rollingston. Additionally, the proposed mitigatory treatment will obscure views of the lake surface from Strait Highway 8. Only part of the mounding vegetation treatment that relates to Jack's Point and Handy Downs parts of the zone uses augmented original topography. The mounding vegetation treatment adjacent to RHD SH1 and OSA activity areas, as per the proposed structure plan, is entirely creative and does not relate to pre-existing topography. The same can be said of the vegetative treatment to the east of RJP SH1 and 2, and I'll refer to Appendix 1, commissioners, I'll take you through the appendix in a minute, and of the very extensive mounding in the southeastern part of the OSL, pursuant to a resource consent. All of this mitigatory work was entirely created and did not augment previously existing topography and vegetation. I think that's the best way, commissioners, if I just read through the summary and then I'll go through the appendices after that.
Okay.
With reference to Appendix 1 of this summary, can be seen that very significant parts of the Jack's Point, part of the Jack's Point Resort Zone, have been created in what was open pastureland, something that Dr. Reed criticises the requested relief for. Due to what I set out in paragraphs 7 and 8 above, that's just 6 and 7, commissioners, I consider that while the change from open pasture to the treatment that is requested by the submission is a considerable change in character, it is not a change that is significantly different to that which has taken place in the immediate north. It is not a change that is at odds with its context, and it is not a change that will bring problematic adverse landscape character effects. I note that provisions of the Jack's Point Resort Zone Operative and Notified specifically contemplate landscaping as a means of mitigating visual effects as experienced from the highway. There's a policy there. Dr. Reed opines that the mounding that forms part of the requested outcome would obscure views of the lake surface from State Highway 6. Appendix 2 of this evening's summary is a series of marked up photographs showing the location of proposed mounding that has the potential to screen visibility of the lake surface. I consider that the visual effect of the screening of the lake surface will be a slightly greater price. Dr. Reed also comments that in addition to views from Hackett Road that I show on Appendix 8 of my evidence in chief, Hackett Road is inside Jack's Point, there may also be visibility to the relevant area from properties further west in Jack's Point Rise. I agree and discuss that from paragraphs 6, 18, 6, 22 of my evidence. The location on Hackett Road from which my Appendix 8 photographs are taken are the locations that allow most visibility to the relevant area. Visibility becomes less as one extends Jack's Point Rise to the west. I consider that I accurately describe the relevant visual effects in my evidence in chief. For all the reasons set out in the summary in my evidence in chief, I consider that in landscape planning terms is considerable logic in the request for relief. So if we go to the appendices, commissioners, the first two appendices are just two aerial photographs of the Jack's Point area taken at different dates. So the very first image, aerial image one, is from 2004. And on that image you can see earthworks that are the beginning of the formation of Maori Jack Road as it comes off the highway. If you flip over to the second image, that's from 2015, and that's Jack's Point largely as it looks today. There's people housed now, but that's the developed areas. So if you compare the two, and on the first image, as I say, you can see the earthworks in Maori Jack Road, and the second image you can see Maori Jack Road itself. You can see where those pods of residential development have been placed. And they've been placed on land either side of Maori Jack Road. That really was open pasture. If we then move on to Appendix 2, the first page of Appendix 2 there is a plan that was part of the memo sent setting up the event of relief. It's just an earthworks plan showing the earthworks proposed in relation to A, B and C. But if you look up on State Highway 6, there's some red numbers, and those are the points from which I've taken photographs. So if we then move on to the photographs, which is the next part. Image 1, which is up to the north, near the built part of Jack's Point, looking more or less to the south across the Homestead Bay area. The orange line that I've drawn is the apex of the mounding that is associated with those A to B areas. If you go down to the explanation at the bottom there, the orange line indicates the apex of the proposed mounding along the northern and eastern areas of RHB A to C, and then there's a yellow line doesn't appear in this photo, but appears on the other ones, which is the mounding proposed along the eastern edge of RHB D.
May I ask for just you
take
that one
piece
and make a conclusion about what
kind of thing is the lake and what can't be seen, right? Yes, certainly. So in this particular image, under the current situation, we can't see the lake surface either way, but that orange line shows the degree to which landform would rise if this mounting is done.
So then you can't see the lake surface.
You can't see the lake surface from that point either way. If we move on to image 2, and you can flip back to my photo point location plan, image 2 is a little bit further to the south. And that driveway you can see there in the very foreground of image 2 is the driveway that leads to the skydiving operation. Now again, the orange line is the line associated with the mounding, the apex of the mounding for areas A to C. So it's the mounding that's closest to the highway. And in fact, you can see what I've done there is I've married up the tops of poles that are on the site today. And those poles, the top of the pole is orange dazzle paint, and the top of the pole indicates the height of the proposed mounting. The bottom of the pole obviously is an existing ground level. So the height of the pole is the height of the rise, if you like. So that those, the orange line is the line of the mounting closest to the viewer, and then further back you can see a yellow line, and that line is the mounting associated with area D. And so that line shows that the rounded ridge line that you can see some water tanks sitting on it, that rounded ridge line will rise. And at its highest, the highest rise is 4.5 metres. So many other parts will rise less than that, but that's the rise.
So the implication of that plan is that the houses in areas A, B and C will not see the lake. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, not in that direction, certainly.
No. Yes, they'll see it if they look south.
They may see it if they look south.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Depending on exactly where they are.
That's right.
Yes.
Is it also fair to conclude that the house, at least from here, the housing in Area D, which the council is not opposed to, has a greater effect on the loss of use than A to C, which they are?
Well, it has a greater effect on the loss of views of the lake surface from State Highway 6.
Yeah, but it's not, that's the thing in the local county, it's just a different area of the
No, I think you're correct.
Okay. I just need to be sure.
Well, I can't speak for that. I think you're understanding the same as mine. To go back to your question a minute ago, obviously in image 2, some of the surface of the lake will be lost in view of the State Highway 6.
We depart from image 2. Can I ask you to comment on the proposition that was made in Dr. Reed's evidence, and I also think adopted by Ms. Jones, about the invisibility of housing not being a policy outcome required of either the rural or the Jack's Point zone, and what the implications of that might be in relation to the mound that is in front of Area D. Do you have any views on that?
Well, I agree with the point that there's no policy in the Jack's Point zone, certainly, that says houses need to be invisible. There is this policy that says built form should not be readily visible from the state highway. There's always been a bit of confusion, I think, about what that term means, not readily visible. But if we look at the built part of Jack's Point, we can see that obviously houses are visible. They're not a really prominent part of the composition of views, I don't think. They're quite peripheral for a state highway user, but state highway users certainly is aware they're there. So that's what that policy has brought about, that degree of visibility. The rural zone, again, doesn't have anything about invisibility. So these mounds that I've drawn lines on have been designed such that houses will be invisible. The mounds could be made smaller, and some degree of visibility would occur if you made the mounds smaller.
If you remove the mounds around Area D,
yes.
How much, to what extent would houses be visible? Would it be to the same yellow line on Figure 2, or would it be lower?
Well, it's a bit difficult to predict exactly, but houses wouldn't completely fill the area that is shown by the yellow line, but in my understanding, the apex of roofs would come more or less to the yellow line, it's very slightly below the yellow line.
So it would be a broken form rather than a solid form.
That's probably the best way of saying it. It would be a broken form rather than a solid form, but of course it would be a form that is obviously built form, whereas a solid form would be a mound that ties into the role of topography. So, yeah, the forms are different forms. They signify something different to a people.
I need to clarify. I don't know if I quite understood what you were saying. So the area between the orange line and the yellow line, is that what we're talking about?
No, I'm talking about a bit beyond the yellow line.
Beyond the yellow line?
Yes.
Yeah.
You're talking really about, in that composition of that particular view, you're talking about the area between the yellow line down to the ground.
The yellow line.
So, can I just interpose here, perhaps to help Commissioner Mountford? Then if you go back to your first plan in the set, which is the earthworks plan, and can you confirm whether the yellow line on your image 2 represents the blue mounting immediately to the east of area R and B D?
Yes.
Yes, that's what I thought. So that yellow line will take out any visibility of housing.
Yes, it will.
On an area D.
Yes.
So what I'm interested in is, if there was no yellow line, what would you see?
Yes, well you see the upper part of buildings.
You see the upper part of buildings in the area between the two lines?
No, not in the area, well,
yeah,
in the area between the yellow line and the ground. If you can see, you see the ground at the water tanks are sitting on.
Yeah, but it's pretty hard to see. I mean, because of a fairly oblique angle, there's a lot of ground and what looks like a very narrow band.
Yes.
So that's hard to visualize.
Yes, yes. But there wouldn't be any building on the piece of ground you can see in that image.
There wouldn't be.
That sits between the orange line and the bottom of the water tank.
There wouldn't be anything visible there.
No, wouldn't be anything visible
there. Where are the, so in terms of the earthworks then, where are the water tanks?
The water tanks are in the middle of the big blue blob at the eastern edge of D.
So in addition to seeing, if you didn't have the mounding behind Area D, in addition to seeing built form, presumably you see any landscaping or people that are around your individual properties?
Well, you'd see the upper parts of trees.
Yes.
See the upper parts of trees.
Yes, you wouldn't see tussocks, but
no.
Anything substantial that was planted.
That's right. It might be useful, sir, to go to, well, if I've got in front of you the evidence that my evidence of chief. Well, the appendices are my
evidence. Which appendix?
We go to appendix. Go to appendix one, which are plans of the requested situation.
Yeah.
And the third sheet of appendix one.
This looks for the sheet as its own document.
The one with the hot pink boundaries around the different
areas. That's right. And that shows area D. Yep. And it shows contours as well. And the contours are the proposed contours. Those contours include the proposed mounting. So you can see where that easternmost edge of area D sits in relation to the mounting. So if that mounting wasn't there, the very eastern edge of area D would be practically on that ridge line that the woods next door.
Say that again.
The easternmost edge of area D would coincide more or less with the ridge line that you can see in my photograph too, that the water tanks sit on.
Yeah.
So beyond the water tanks is area D in that photograph. So if people built houses in area D that stick up 3 metres, 4 metres above that ridge line,
that's what you'd see.
You'd see.
Yeah. Right.
And just to follow up then, the next scenario, how much of related surface could be visible?
Well,
as
the chair said, the broken lines, if you like. So between houses, you see like, well, of course, there'd be trees and things as well.
So just in terms of looking at that plan, the pink line shows what is thought by the submitter, and the black line is more similar to that that the council, I think, are suggesting as alternative.
Well, the black line isn't the actual line of what the council is suggesting, but
I'm just wondering if. If the houses were built to the black lines rather than the pink line, the east, to what extent would they be seen without any measurement?
Well, yes, I don't really know. I imagine you'd see very little of
them. Yes, yes. Scenario A actually extends it slightly east of the black line, but probably no more than 20 metres or so, so it would be very little.
Just
what
I imagine would be very little.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that's my image 2. If we flip over into my image 3, which is further to the south again, this is coming down south closer towards Lakeside Estate. And there's a view again across towards the lake and the state highway, and again the orange line is the mounting in relation to areas A to C, and the yellow line is the mounting in relation to area D, and area D houses would be invisible behind that yellow line, and the yellow line takes out a little bit of the lake surface. I do say there in the blue below the photos, from that point, if the viewer turns his head slightly to the left, you get a broad view of the lake surface.
Mm-hmm.
So this is only taking us a strip on a path when you don't bring too much to the center, if you like. And we flip over to image 4, which is again from the same point, but looking slightly more to the south, but as I say, if you turn to the south to see the lake, there's the same two lines again. The mounting in relation to areas A to C, and the mounting in relation to areas D.
Yes, but I'd like it to fashion them in the same attitude. Is this a case of it's been such a long time since the conceptualisation of the Jack's Point special zone that the approach to dealing with the visibility of houses as they are in the context of our analysis changed?
Well, I don't know if it's to do with fashion. I think it's probably more to do with the request of being particularly cautious. I mean, I was asked to assess the design that we see here, and that's what I've assessed.
Yesterday, when we were discussing the council proposals, I was wondering, I had at that point, having seen that lovely terrace, you know, that flat land that slopes west from the stage highway outwards, wondered whether or not another mechanism for dealing with the distance between the houses and the A to C and the highway would do the job. But having seen what you've produced, I don't think the concern exists with A to C that I had developed yesterday in my mind. So I would like to know, I guess I'm talking out here rather than asking you questions, but it's just a puzzle to me really, is it, given what's happened at that point, is it desirable to continue that process into the future, or is there another way of dealing with those, what I regard as the continuation of the land on the eastern side and the slope going from the left side?
Well, I guess there are a number of options that could have been taken, I suppose. I think there's logic in continuing or mirroring or at least relating to the treatment that's occurred to the north. You know, it's a fact that the treatment that has occurred to the north is there, and I think it's quite a successful outcome. I think for a state highway user approaching Queenstown, given the density that exists in Jack's Point, given that it's housing a lot of population, I think it's a very pleasant community outcome to drive from the lake all the way really to the Kelvin Heights turnoff before you sort of lose the countryside. So I think what's been done has worked quite well, and I think there's therefore logic in marrying into that rather than doing something completely new.
And I'll just follow up with the question about whether you're aware of submissions from Hilton Kingsgrass, which is Kingsman, isn't it, about the Coburn industrial area, the existing quarry on the eastern side, and quite a significant area, I think 60 or 70 hectares is proposed or sought as industrial zoning for yard-based activities. Naturally, there's been discussion about the landscape and with the did you consider that submission and its consequences when you were considering what happens when you're driving into town from the south?
Well, I was aware of it. I don't think it really influenced what I would find in relation to Homestead Bay. Whether that relief went ahead or not, I don't think it really influenced the approach I've taken to this.
Because?
Well, I think, I haven't been asked to assess that zoning, and I don't, so I therefore can't say whether I would agree with it or not, but if it's there, I can't see that would change my opinion of this. I can't see that I would therefore think that this is inappropriate, and if it's not there, I still think this is appropriate. I think the design approach that is most useful for Homestead Bay is really influenced by the experience of driving on the highway corridor and by what's happened at Jack's Point. It's not properly influenced by what happens at the easement.
But just before you get to that, you drive past Lakeside Estates.
Yes.
And that's rather more developed, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Lakeside Estates is a little bit on its own in the area, as far as the sequential experience of approaching Queenstown, it's sort of a bit of an anomaly almost sitting there. But it's part of the existing environment, and a highway user has passed it quickly. It's well screened with vegetation. You're aware it's there, I suppose. But I couldn't see, see what you're saying. There's two approaches. I wouldn't really think an appropriate outcome would be to continue Lakeside Space just because it's there. Right. So I'm not saying you should just continue what's there because it's there. Mm. I'm saying we can mirror what's happened with Jack's Point because it's appropriate.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to understand your view overall on the entry.
Someone else might like to pick up a question while I
get to the audience. Well, my questions were all about the ridges as they've been
answered. Just in terms of just in the summary in paragraph little 4.3b, you talk about the naturalness that characterises these views. Is that naturalness the rural character, or is it something more natural that you're referring to there?
Right, 3b, detraction from the naturalness as experienced from the lake surface. Well, there really I'm summarising apart from my evidence in chief, where I talk about users of the lake surface that look at Homestead Bay from the south and southwest.
Mm.
Under the operative situation, in a nutshell, what I say to my evidence in chief is that under the operative situation, the village will appear with some relatively low density things around it, and from those parts of the lake, you really don't see Jack's Point development. And so your visual experience is dominated by an O&L type experience,
the
landform of Jack's Point itself, and then the remarkables in the lake surface. And so the operative situation, I think, would bring about a detraction from that overwhelming naturalness, and the proposed situation will bring about a slight increase in detraction, if you like.
Okay. Thank you. The other question I had was, overall in your assessment, you've assessed the relief sought by the submitter against the ODP situation. What about your assessment comparing the immediate relief against the notified proposed district plan situation?
Which is, I think I mentioned that in my evidence in chief.
Well, I'm looking at paragraph 626 in the evidence in chief, when I made a note of that question. Understanding that the assessment at that point had been against the ODP rather than the PDP. And that's why I raised it. I mean, maybe something that I've missed. Could you read it?
There is somewhere early on, I'm sure, where the landscape outcomes sought by the ODP at a broad level that I set out primarily in section 4 of the ODP, district-wide landscape issues, PDP arranges it differently, obviously, in section 6 of the PDP. As far as the broad scale landscape outcomes that are sought in relation to an area, in relation to this area, I think my assessment really isn't referring specifically to the ODP or PDP. The outcomes sought are similar. They seek to preserve the ONLs, they seek to preserve rural amenity. So yeah, I haven't tailored it to one or the other. I suppose it's really been an assessment from first principles in relation to how both the ODP and PDP deal with ONLs and the main step in amenity.
From first principles, what the potential of development capacity of this land is in terms of the landscape constraints and the goals of the proposed plans. But if you have, I'd like to know what you think.
Well, I guess I haven't really been influenced too much by issues of capacity or demand or required capacity in relation to population growth. I've tried to stay away from that really, because I think that's really outside of the landscape scope. In a nutshell, I've been asked to assess a particular outcome, and I've assessed that. I suppose in very broad terms, I would say that in very broad landscape planning terms, it appears to me that if we have to house a vastly increased population, then doing it in locations like this at a broad level is better than doing it in other locations. These are places that can absorb population.
Put the question to you another way, perhaps. If you had been asked to design it in a way that achieved similar landscape outcomes, would you be able to, would you have designed it more than in development?
Well, that would come down to what I was asked to do, I suppose, but I don't see why these areas that have been drawn to accommodate suburban densities, I don't see why they couldn't be denser.
Could they be larger?
Possibly, although in relation to the mounding and topographical layout of these areas, a lot of work was done, a lot of survey and site modelling, sight line modelling from the highway work was done, and I analysed a lot of sort of view-shed plans and that sort of thing, and the shapes that ended up being drawn were drawn on the basis of having minimal impact on the state highway, so the people designing it knew that was a key driver. I doubt whether they can get too much without sprawling into areas that start to cause more visual effects. That's my understanding of it without analysing it in detail.
Quite a lot about the shortcomings and analysis of the highway.
I recall that he did. I mean, primarily I produced these, the images that are attached to my summary, in response to Dr. Reed's comments that the proposed navigation design, if you like, the Naomi Plane, was going to cause adverse effects. It's my opinion that the proposed navigation design won't really cause significant adverse effects because it ties in with what's to the immediate north, and because when you actually look at the landscape with the height poles and so on, although the mountains sound high, they're quite distant from the viewer, and when you look at a 4 metre high mountain from 300 metres away, it looks like a field of gently rolling in the landscape.
I just wanted to check that you'd read this evidence.
I have read it, I recall reading it, yes.
Well, yes, because we're going to have to ask him questions too. So as long as you take this into account. Thank you. That's enough from me.
Any other questions? I have a question.
You might observe that we don't actually have a lot to say about an aspect of Mr. Ferguson's evidence where he and I think Mr. Williams expresses concerns about effects on residential amenity from within the Jazz Point zone.
Yes.
The view that we have come to as a team in our approach to the matter is that we don't see that the policy framework in the Jazz Point zone serves to protect views into our client's site from within the residential areas of the Jack's Point zone. The policy structure of the zone is very much one of controlling externalities rather than internal residential immunity. So that's why we haven't spent a great deal of time examining view shafts from houses within what is effectively a former suburban subdivision looking outwards to the south.
But this is not yet an internal situation in the land your client is setting is zone rural.
That's the present time, but if you accept the submission, what? The extension of the zone only gets to be developed if you include it in the zone.
Yeah.
If once you've made that decision that it's in the zone, then the policy framework of the zone applies.
But in the meantime, surely the policy driven in relation to the rural zone apply.
Yes, but if the...
And isn't that the first decision, to shift from rural to...
That is the first decision.
And so, in making that decision, we need to look at the visual effect into that rural area.
Well, I might be being pedantic, but can I just scroll back? The first decision is not to shift from rural to residential. The first decision is which is the appropriate zone.
All right.
So the proposition that we're advancing to you is that the additional residential development, which is contemplated by the submission, can and will only occur if you include the site within the Jack's Point zone. And in that event, the immunity expectations are driven by the policy framework of that zone.
No, I'm not with you. I mean, I can understand what you're saying. It seems like a statement of the obvious, if you get to that point.
Yes.
But you have to get to that point. And before you get to that point, you need to consider the effect which the Jack's Point residents have. And their witnesses are raising.
Yes, but even their expectations are determined in my submission by the policy framework that applies in the zone that they occupy.
Really? I'm struggling to understand that. Surely they're entitled to rely for the time being and to defend the rural zone and all it brings with it.
Well, no, my submission, you start with the proposition that it doesn't have a rural zone. Set that with a notified zone, certainly. But the submission is that it shouldn't be the rural zone, so that we don't have a default rural zone versus a change to that.
Well, I'm not understanding you at all on that, I'm not just saying.
I think we can cover that when you follow up these submissions.
Perhaps Mr. Bartlett could be most convenient next.
Oh, you're here. Oh, you're here. Yeah. No, you could be able to take that, but certainly you can hear Mr. Bartlett's summary before we introduce
yes.
All right. I'm going to slightly break the tradition here because I've got an abridged version of my summary, or the version that contains a lot of traffic modelling, which will be scrutinised, I dare say, by other traffic experts, so therefore has to form part of my...
And it's too early in the morning for us to go to sleep as well.
Well, I'm not going to cover it, other than the fact that... If you would like a traffic modelling, including the traffic modelling, please ask for a quick one, and if not, there's an abridged version. I suggest that the council record has the larger version with the traffic modelling. And I have another couple of packages of just the traffic modelling here as well. If anyone feels hard done by. Essentially, my introduction, I'll start from paragraph 2. That's the first bit, just simply says what we're dealing with, I say, and what the matter is. So, in preparing this summary and supplementary evidence, I have reviewed the rebuttal evidence of Ms. Wendy Vance, or QLBC, the rebuttal evidence of Mr. Anthony McCull, of NZTA, the rebuttal evidence of Mr. Anthony Sizemore for NZTA, and the rebuttal evidence of Mr. Andrew Carr for JPROA. In this evidence, I have provided supplementary information with respect to a possible access intersection from Kingston Road, State Highway 6, and traffic modelling for access to the zone change via Marajack Road, or direct access from the new State Highway, or a new intersection from State Highway 6. The primary concern raised by Ms. Banks appears to be the lack of traffic modelling to confirm that a direct State Highway 6 access to the additional 541 residential lots within Homestead Bay is possible. This is driven by the number of dwellings within the overall Rat-Dax Point zone being significantly greater than provided for in the current QLBC/NZTA traffic model. It appears from this concern that Ms. Banks does not support the overall network modelling undertaken by QLBC and NZTA in 2006. Within this evidence, I will provide further modelling for the proposed access to the extension of the Homestead Bay portion of the Jacks Point zone. The rebuttal evidence of Mr. McCull and Mr. Sizemore, both for NZTA, raised concerns that they have not been provided with any details of possible direct access from State Highway 6 to suburbly extended Homestead Bay residential area. In addition, Mr. McCull and Mr. Sizemore would both expect the increased traffic from Homestead Bay would ideally use the existing Jacks Point Zone accesses if this is possible. Both consider that the provision of a further State Highway 6 access, if required, would be outside of the district plan process. The rebuttal evidence of Mr. Carr, or JPROA, was primarily concerned with potential traffic effects of the Homestead Bay extension on the residents of Jacks Point. This included effects of traffic on Marajack Road, which is a privately owned road operated by Jacks Point Residents and Owners Association, and at the existing intersection with State Highway 6. Mr. Carr considers that operational effects of the intersection of Marajack Road and State Highway 6 would be direct downstream traffic effects that should be assessed. So, just to go through the supplementary evidence that I am providing here, I've undertaken traffic modelling in order to consider concerns raised with the rebuttal evidence, or within the rebuttal evidence, sorry. To undertake this, I have had to establish both a design base year line without the additional 541 residential lots at Homestead Bay. To complete this, I have relied on the following. based traffic flow on State Highway 6 is from the QLEC NZCA traffic model. For State Highway 6 traffic, I have used the 2045 AM and PM peak period traffic flows. 2045 is likely to be well beyond the anticipated design year for this zone change and a robust basis for assessment. Base traffic for the Jack's Point portion of Jack's Point zone is based on development of 800 residential dwellings. This is considered to be a realistic base traffic flow for Jack's Mary Jack Road. The portion of Homestead Bay development enabled under the operative district plan, 244 residential dwellings, will use Mary Jack Road for access. This portion of Homestead Bay traffic is considered to use Mary Jack Road regardless of alternative access options. And the traffic generation and distribution rates are based on the evidence of Mr. Carr. It is noted that this is identical to the generation and distribution rate assumed in the QODC traffic model for the Jack's Point zone. The traffic distributions and modelling results are provided in attachment A. That's as if you would like to look at it or not. So, for the allowable development of Jack's Point and Homestead Bay, 244 dwellings, the Mary Jack Road intersection with East State Highway 6 will generally operate efficiently with queuing, delay 10 seconds AM and 25 seconds PM at the right turn from Mary Jack Road to State Highway 6. The maximum queue length for this manoeuvre would be less than one vehicle. For modelling, I have assumed scenario 1, where all development of Jack Point and Homestead Bay, which is a total of 785 dwellings of Homestead Bay, use the existing intersection of Mary Jack Road with State Highway 6. This scenario showed that in the AM peak period, the left turn from Mary Jack Road to State Highway 6 would fail. And in the PM peak period, the right turn from State Highway 6 to Mary Jack Road would have an increased queue length. The delayed right turn from Mary Jack Road to State Highway 6 will increase, although maximum queue length will still be less than one vehicle. To manage the additional traffic for this model scenario, the following improvements will be required. Create a left turn lane from Mary Jack Road and merge to east for State Highway 6, northbound to reduce delays and queuing. Extend the existing right turn bay to accommodate longer right turn queues without affecting southbound through traffic. So that's actually all on State Highway 6, by the way. And increased capacity of Mary Jack Road link for vehicular traffic and pedestrians. In particular, increasing the footpath provision on Mary Jack Road and widening the existing side road intersections within Jack's Point. This would be required to increase the capacity of the existing rail and side rail intersections. It is expected that any improvements necessary, such as those noted, would be part of any agreement with Jack's Point residents and owners association. Based on the model scenario 1, both NZTA and Jack's Point residents and owners associations, approvals will be required to improve the capacity of Mary Jack Road and the intersection of State Highway 6. Without the approval of Jack's Point residents and owners association, a new State Highway intersection will be required to facilitate the extension of Homestead Bay residential road. I have considered a scenario 2 where Jack's Point and a portion of Homestead Bay, 244 residential dwellings, would use the existing Mary Jack Road intersection with State Highway 6. In this scenario, a new State Highway intersection would be provided to access the additional 541 residential dwellings at Homestead Bay. This scenario allows for increased through traffic at the existing Mary Jack Road intersection, which is a concern raised by Mr. Carr and his rebuttal evidence. Scenario 2 is reliant on a new access intersection to be located at existing registered crossing place CP48. This intersection would be similar to the existing Mary Jack Road intersection and can be designed in accordance with current Austroads guidance. Attachment B, which you actually all have that one, provides a possible intersection layout at the location. At that location, the available visibility site distance is in excess of 300 metres in each direction, which is a desirable safe intersection site distance for 110 kilometre per hour operating speed. I acknowledge the concerns of Mr. McCull and Mr. Sizemore regarding the lack of detailed site information. For the avoidance of doubt, the visibility site distance at the site are approximately 400 metres to the south and 500 metres to the north. And just as a side, the layout provided in Mr. Espy's evidence does show that route up towards the state highway towards the Lakeside State end of the property. Scenario 2 would be the only viable access to the proposed Homestead Bay extension for JPRO if they do not approve access via Mary Jack Road. The Scenario 2 modelling suggests that the T intersection with State Highway 6 would generally operate efficiently. Sorry, that should be the new T intersection with State Highway 6 would generally operate efficiently with minimal queuing. With this scenario, the downstream effects at the Mary Jack Road intersection would be significantly increased left turn queues in the AM peak period. This can be relieved by the provision of a left turn lane from Mary Jack Road and merge to State Highway 6 northbound. Slight increase in the queue length for right turning from State Highway 6 to Mary Jack Road. This may require the extension of the existing right turn bay. The delay for this manoeuvre will be minimal, approximately 12 seconds. Increased queuing for right turning traffic from Mary Jack Road to both the AM and PM peak periods, although the maximum queue length will still be less than one vehicle. This scenario 2 traffic modelling suggests that if a new state highway intersection is provided, then there will be a need for improvements at the existing intersection of Mary Jack Road. These improvements are of a similar nature identified in scenario 1 modelling. I have not transferred this modelling to other proposed state highway accesses to serve the Jack Point zone. It is expected that any additional improvements works at these intersections would be at the discretion of NZTA. Should NZTA wish to retain or improve the operational efficiency or safety of the state highway network beyond the immediate site, this is likely to form part of any approvals from NZTA. At this stage, it is noted that the State Highway 6 intersection with Wolsey Road is limited to construction traffic only. The modelling that I have undertaken is relatively detailed in nature. It is likely that this modelling will need to be repeated for any NZTA approvals at the time of development. As the order of development within the Jack's Point zone progresses, it is likely that additional modelling will be required by NZTA based on the extent of development permitted and a realistic expectation of future design traffic. This has been the case with other intersections on the State Highway network, regardless of details discussed and agreed at previous planning stages. It is possible that other development within or beyond the Jack's Point zone may change the intersection layout or method of control. The modelling undertaken demonstrates that it is possible to provide an access to the proposed Homestead Bay extension facilitated by the submission. The access to the extension may be either a new access intersection from State Highway 6 or via Mary Jack Road. These options both require approvals from third parties. And just to summarise the, and I'll start at point two again. Following comments made in rebuttal, I have undertaken a more robust traffic modelling, which shows that access to the proposed zone change can be provided via Mary Jack Road. This will require a number of improvements. If this access methodology is progressed, approvals from both JTROA and NZTA will be required to allow for road upgrades. Or, access to the proposed zone can be provided from a new access to the proposed zone change can be provided from a new intersection onto State Highway 6. This intersection can be constructed to meet the requirements of current Australia's guidance. Improvements will also be required to existing Marriage Gap Road intersection within State Highway 6 and potentially other intersections serving the Jack Point zone. These improvements all require work within the State Highway corridor. If this access methodology progresses, NZTA approval will be required. The additional traffic modelling undertaken does not change my opinions expressed in my evidence. The additional modelling does provide a more robust assessment in order to review potential transport effects and ascertain how these can be minimised. It is acknowledged that although effects can be minimised, approvals of adjacent road control authorities will be required if the level of development of Homestead Bay exceeds the provisions of the operative district plan. I'll just draw your attention, I suppose, to attachment B, which everyone should have, which is just a layout, a standard large T intersection layout, modelled very similar to the existing Marajack Road intersection.
Thank you. We'll do it until 11 o'clock. Sorry, until 12 o'clock.
Yep.